Hi, welcome to Shadows from the Tree, the podcast that invites you to explore the curious world of dark genealogy, uncovering secrets, scandals, crimes, and other darker events that shape family trees. Whether you're a seasoned genealogist, just beginning to explore your family history, a history buff, or even a crime junkie, we offer something to everyone. Join us, your host, Danielle and Michelle. In every episode, we share stories from over a century ago for the first time with each other, always centered around a common theme. By using newspaper archives as our guide and conducting research using historical records, we piece together these often forgotten stories and gain a deeper understanding of the challenges those involved face. Our hope is to connect you, our listeners, with your ancestors' past, one story at a time. So hello, welcome.
Hello.
Here we are. Yep. Another theme, another episode. And this one, I think you just came up with us as we ended last episode, so.
Yeah, we wanted something a little different, so wrongly convicted or, you know, overturned convictions I thought was a cool one to talk about. It was harder to start within the newspapers to find it because, like, wrongly convicted, overturned, like, I don't know, it didn't pop up many things. How about you? Did you get?
Yeah, it was kind of challenging because, like, every time I found something, it, like, the person was, like, already dead. Which I think you had mentioned as well. So I felt like there wasn't really a true story there. And I don't know about you, but when I was searching, I kept on finding like laws of when for people who were wrongly convicted, they would get damage fees. Yeah. And I found that as early, at least in my quick search of 1913. So I guess back then, there was some type of compensation, which I guess was good for people who, you know, shouldn't have been there in the first place.
Right. Yeah, definitely. So I had started with a website called For Justice, FORE.org, for a wrongly convicted database record. So they actually have a great index. So I just was looking for ones from the 1800s. You know, I love that century. So I was looking for something kind of in New England, local base, so I could find some good newspaper articles because I know the Boston Globe, Providence Journal, they have really easily accessible records on
and our, I feel like we found over time that if there was a bigger event happening, they do somehow always get over to like the New York Times and Boston Globe newspapers.
Exactly.
Yeah. If I was going to travel, it traveled there.
Yeah. Pretty far outreach.
Yeah.
So this one, the charge actually goes really well with our theme from last time. So he was charged with polygamy.
Oh, okay. So we had a gotcha.
Yeah. So kind of, you know, tied in as well. His sentence was for 3 years, of which he served over a year and a half. So like about a half of that. So the year the crime took place was 1885. And it was in Massachusetts. So we'll start with his name. So George W. Benway, aka John Benway, was wrongly convicted on April 13, 1885, of polygamy in Norfolk County, Massachusetts. So after Benway's first wife left him, he believed she was dead, and he ended up remarrying a woman and had several children with her. So he was prosecuted, and they believed that he just left his other wife or didn't get a divorce from her.
At least the court actually did something with him, unlike your last guy.
Yeah, just let him. Well, he was hard to catch. He was like bouncing around the whole country. Nobody could get him in one place. So after his conviction, he was sentenced to the 3 years. So it was discovered, they have written in here, that his first wife had divorced him. So on December 1st, 1886, George W. Benway was granted a full pardon by the Massachusetts governor, Benjamin F. Butler, based on new evidence that his first wife did, in fact, divorce him. Benway was released after a year and 8 months imprisonment, and his remarriage to his second wife made his children legitimate. So that's where I started.
You know,
and then you gotta fact check, right? You gotta like, was this an accurate telling of his sentencing? So he did get sentenced and he did get released, but I was like, I gotta find that marriage record. I gotta find, like, did it really happen? Yeah. Was he really married? Like, why was this brought up so randomly?
Yeah.
And come to find out, in April of 1867. So that's like nearly 20 years before this even came up. He actually married Lucy Eldridge. And he was 21 and she was 16. And they got married in Palmer, Massachusetts. It has his parents' names. Charles and Margaret has her parents' names, Horace and Laura. So there was actually like several records of it. Oh. So like there were some newspapers that said it never even happened. Like he didn't.
But he got charged because they didn't know about this one then. Back then, this wife from 20 years past, they didn't mention that in.
Well, the that was articles. That's the first wife. That's who they said. But why are they bringing it up 20 years later?
Yeah, that's like, a good point.
Why does this even matter? Like, what's going on with this guy?
By the time he gets tried, he's probably gonna be old enough that he's not gonna get married.
Because his first marriage, like, I don't know, there was like rumors in the area that he or had another wife, so someone mentioned it and then got him arrested. So like, I'm just thinking, I'm like, who had beef with this guy?
Exactly, right? That's like a petty thing to
what
to
is
do.
Going on. Like, it wasn't like it was he just married this girl randomly, right? And then like rumors started and they had four children together with his his other wife, whose name was, let me pull it up, Catherine C.F. Brennehy. So she was actually from Ireland. So they had a long marriage. They got married in 1870, so 3 years after the other one. Yeah, so we're talking 15 years that this is like an established couple, and now we're bringing up the dirt. Like,
that's definitely odd. Right? I agree with you.
So I have all these articles of him being pardoned. You know, they're in the Globe. They're all the way in Pennsylvania. So it's like unintentional bigamy. Everyone felt bad. There was even an article that said, he had paid a New York undertaker because he thought like she was dead, like he had paid for her funeral for his first wife. So there was all that coming up. So I'm like, well, I gotta find, like, did she actually die, this Lucy Eldridge? Yeah. And no, she hadn't died until 1884, which was still before the charges were brought up.
So why would he be going around claiming that?
That's wasn't claiming it.
What's your theory? Yeah.
I guess I go further back. So I'm looking up further before this 1885 conviction, right?
Yeah.
So I found this article in the Globe. So charged with the gunpowder plot. Okay. So this is November 22nd, 1883. So here's a couple of years before, okay? So Officer Drugan, hold on, let's read a different one. That one's kind of before the fact. So
now, was this like your other ones where you just found, once you started digging, you found multiple articles?
Yeah. Okay. So, okay, bold attempt to blow up a house. Here we go. So this one's a couple of days before that. So November 19th. A dastardly attempt was made to blow up a house at Ingsingly, Denham, just before 11 o'clock last evening. The house is the property of A.B. Wentworth. Like, doesn't that sound like the company I've seen commercials with that last name. So it was occupied by Mr. John Long, a blacksmith working in Boston. About 11:45, Mr. Long was awakened by Mrs. John W. Benway and her son, who informed Mr. Long that her husband had placed a keg containing powder upon the front of the piazza and had lighted the fuse, which was attached to the keg. Mr. Long hastened from the house, but was afraid to go near the powder because the fuse was now short. Soon after, there was a terrible explosion, which shattered all the windows.
Oh my gosh.
And did considerable damage. But unfortunately, the powder was not contained sufficiently, so there was, you know, less damage than the miscreant had intended. The cause is ascribed to the fact that Benway had been drinking hard that night.
Always.
And was in a state bordering on delirium tremens, so DTs, you know, when you get like... when people are getting off of alcohol, they have those shakes and stuff. So he was delirious, apparently.
Wow.
So at an early hour this morning, an unsuccessful attempt was made to find Benway. A warrant has been issued for his arrest. Mr. Long says he's had trouble with Benway and, you know, has been like, this has had been happening. They've been going back and forth for like 3 years now. So I was like, maybe he was... you know, had loose lips at a bar somewhere and was talking about his first wife or something, and then just starts blowing up some guy's house a couple years before this like polygamy you know, accusation comes up. So I just thought it was weird. And then we go back to the other one, who was this other article. So on the 22nd of November, Officer Drugan stated this morning with a warrant for the arrest of John W. Benway upon the charge of explosion of gunpowder with intent to destroy the building, the penalty of which is 20 years in state prison.
Whoa.
Benway was arrested in, hold on, Woonsocket, Rhode Island, last night, close to home. He is alleged to attempt to destroy the house of John Long last Monday night. So he was arrested. One other article said he was getting work at a railway station and someone recognized him and called it. So, yeah.
This is funny, though, because this is like, if you're doing your family history, if you just found that one article, you'd just be like, okay, you'd make your hypothesis, right?
Yeah.
But you have to keep looking the same surname over and over because now you're like piecing together a bigger story that
like
changes the context.
Oh, well, he was either the town drunk and everyone was just trying to get rid of him. Like, why didn't he get charged with the first thing? So they were probably mad he got away with trying to blow up their house. So, yeah. So I was trying to find the first wife because they were like, we can't find any records that she actually died. And I did find one family tree that said she had passed away from tuberculosis in 1884. So she couldn't say like, yay or nay, we were divorced or not. So after, you know, the governor had pardoned him, it looks like in the articles it says 3 days later, there were marriage intentions. So he was released like that first week of December of 1886. And then there's an article on the 9th of December of marriage intentions. So John W. Benway, 41, and Catherine C.F. Brennehy, so she's going by her maiden name again, of 40 years old, are going to get married. And then they did get married that following year. So beginning of 1887, so in January they got married on the 7th. So, and they did have 4 children. They had way back before all of this started. So their first child was born in 1871, Alfred A. Benway. Then they had a child in 74, Frederick Charles Benway. Then 76, Caroline. And then 1881, George. So they were married for a very long time before.
It means that if they have 4 children, there's probably ancestors out there, like people out there.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, no, the family tree kept going in several different
directions
there. So I was trying to find his death, trying to find George or John, like any records of that. I couldn't find a gravestone. I couldn't find a family plot. I couldn't find probate.
Frustrating.
But I did find an article that a John Benway and his son George were suing the Boston and Worcester Street Railway Company after an accident in Southborough. So that happened in 1904. So he was still alive in 1904, and they were suing for a good amount. So there was a whole group, I guess, that were on the railway when an accident happened, and they were suing for $39,000 altogether.
Wow.
So John and George were suing for $7,000 between the two of them. So I don't know if they ever
early retirement
if they ever got that money. But his wife, her obituary was in the paper on Christmas Day, 1905, so the following year, and it says that she was a widow. So he must have died between suing. Was he like, was he offed by the railway company so they didn't have to pay him? Like, there's no record of the man's death anywhere. Like,
so weird, right?
Yeah.
And frustrating.
Yeah, definitely.
To not have like a clear cut answer.
Yeah. So I don't know what happened to his,
did it say how long? Well, he got pardoned. So how long did it take them to actually say you're guilty?
Oh,
was it a long trial? I can't imagine that it was super long.
No, I don't think so. I think his charges were in like March of 85, and he was convicted in April. So
that was really quick.
It wasn't a drawn out trial. He probably didn't have a strong defense.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But it was all circumstantial. Like,
did
they have the record of his first? Because I found the record of his first.
It's funny, like, what do you think? Like, how do you think people back then, like in that century looked for records. Like, here we are just at our computer, right? Just typing, like, were they walking to the town hall and did they have like a vault back then or a book? You know, I'm obviously they had the books because we see them.
Yeah, they had a town clerk, I'm sure.
But it probably took a lot more time.
Get in their cart, their horse and buggy, go all the way to Palmer.
To interview everybody.
Yeah. I don't even know how far is Palmer from Boston. Yeah,
I haven't heard of Palmer. Yeah, you said Dedham, right? Definitely heard of Dedham.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
Which is pretty interesting. So, his second wife, Catherine, she did pass away from a valve disease of the heart. So, I found her death record, but it doesn't say, like, it has, like, her probate news. So, it was all left to her children, like her daughter and her sons. So, see Gertrude. So, that was Caroline. And so, anything that she had was left to them. So, he was either dead or not around anymore.
Not in the picture.
Yeah. She said she was a widow. So there were other records of other John Benways, but in like Vermont and stuff, but it like didn't match up.
I don't think I've ever really heard that surname before.
No, it didn't match up to any other like people in the family, unless you just kind of hightailed it out of there. Who knows?
Taking notes from that other guy.
Who knows? Maybe he did have George and he went by George and John in like, his first marriage was under George, so maybe that's why they couldn't find it.
Yeah.
And then his second marriage was under John.
Do you know what, like, what culture he was? Like, where he... I just wonder, because I know, like, with the Canadian records in my family, and you're either, like, a Marie or a, you know, something else, and that's always, like, your baptized name, and then so you try to look for records, and it's just confusing.
Yeah, he was born in Plattsburgh, New York.
Oh, okay.
So I couldn't, like, I couldn't get much further from that. But I guess I could look up his father, Charles, or his mother and see if they were.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well.
Good story that had lots of
little where am I going to go now?
Side trails to go down. But yeah.
I thought it was a little
lighter than some of the others that I've done.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's definitely some dark ones. Had I had more time, I could have really spent time just looking at these poor people who.
Right. We could do a whole series on.
You really could
wrong
because.
Convictions.
It's just really sad, and I was trying to look for like a really, really big case personally, but I just stuck with one that, even though I'll just say it now, like even though my person who was wrongfully imprisoned has like no records, very hard to find. My story has like several surnames in it, like multiple. So I felt really good about like reaching multiple people.
Yeah.
So I was like, I'll just go with it. And then be annoyed later that I can't find anything.
So, that's always how it goes.
Yeah. Well, very good. Well, I guess I can headway into mine. Yeah. So like I just mentioned, I have a guy, and I'm going to kind of get into the story first of what happened before, and then I'll bring him in. So on the night of August 9th, 1894, a train on the Rock Island Railroad was making its way across a bridge near Lincoln, Nebraska, and the train was traveling at about 50 miles per hour, they were saying, trying to make up on lost time from running 10 minutes late at one of the prior stops in Fairbury. And tragically, the train derailed, plummeting 40 feet and resulting in a catastrophic explosion.
Yikes.
So fire and everything. 11 people lost their lives that night, and they primarily died, most of them due to being crushed by the wreckage. So just not
that
sad, right? Depressing.
Horrific.
Yeah. And I have a list, and I'm, like I just mentioned, like reaching a lot of people.
Right.
Listen up, because here are the names of the 11 people that unfortunately did not make it in that wreck. So we had Ike DePew, who was the engineer. He was from Council Bluffs. There was C.D. Stannard. He was a conductor and from St. Joseph. There was William Craig, who was a fireman, also Council Bluffs. There was Dr. C.H. Pinney from Council Bluffs. J.D. Matthews, a commercial man from Omaha, Harry Morse from Kansas City, W.H. Hamble, a lawyer from Fairbury, Nebraska, John Munger, a grain dealer from Omaha, H.R. Peters, a merchant in Council Bluffs, and E.H. Zernick, a lawyer from Lincoln, Nebraska. And then last, there was Andrew Hansen, a farmer from the McPherson County in Nebraska. So, I mean, we're talking losing people who had really great careers, right, and, you know, just
honorable members of society.
Yeah. Yep. So very unfortunate that they lost that many people. And really, it was considered at that time like the largest mass murder, in a sense, of that time period in that place. So the aftermath of the wreck was very chaotic. There was a person by the name of W.M. Saxton, who was the son of a nearby farmer, who rushed to get help, while survivors like Cole J.C. Bills and Harry Footy worked to really rescue the people who were trapped. And it was even a note that, and I said Footy, it should be Foot, sorry. He actually, oddly enough, broke his leg and foot, but was still trying to rescue the people.
Sometimes the adrenaline, you know, like the moms who can lift the,
exactly,
the cars, you just kind of, you just power through.
Because like there was an, you know, it was mentioned that there was like screaming, people screaming from hell, like just a really probably something you did not want to witness. But that bravery led to the rescue of 15 more individuals from the rear car. And it was kind of mentioned that the railroad, this was like a big financial loss for them, estimated to be around $30,000. So that's a hit. So not only are you dealing with the sad part about the human life being lost, but the company in itself taking
a
hit.
Were there a lot of people on the train?
Yeah, I think they said it was pretty pretty full. So it's talked about like the different parts of the train. So it only affected like the rear and then one of the main cabins. Mm-hmm. So they started the investigation and began trying to piece together what happened. And that's when they discovered signs of sabotage.
Whoa.
Yes. So they had like marks on the rails indicating that someone had tampered with the train, specifically a crowbar marks. And through their, I guess, interviews, they name a person named George, George Washington Davis. And they said that the witnesses and were, they found him near the crash site with like a lantern. That's like what people kept on saying, with a lantern. So supposedly he was one of the first people on the site, even though he was saying he ran like 4 miles to get there. And I guess he did have some type of criminal past and came to Nebraska not long before this happened. And he became the prime suspect and only suspect of this whole thing. So the investigation quickly turned into like a trial. Of course, there was city detective Malone who initiated a search for Davis, who was found at a nearby farm. And despite his silence really throughout the whole incident, evidence against him seemed compelling. And during that first trial in March of 1895, his attorney did argue that Davis was being used as a scapegoat by the railroad company to help with the financial responsibility of it. There was also, so I guess at this point there was a hung jury. So that first trial for first degree murder didn't take place. There was a few other kind of theories. One was that Davis wanted to get a job working at the railroad. So he purposely like took off pieces of the track in hopes to then be like the hero to fix it before the train came through. And then there was another story about him working with somebody else and then that person not allowing them to then fix it. And then there was another theory that I'm trying to think of the third one, actually. Now that I think about it, I'll come to mind. So, you know, I think the first one being like they want him to get a job at the railroad seems pretty fitting if he was just working at a farm and, you know. So in November of 1895, Davis faced his second trial, which was second degree murder. And that concluded in January 1896. So I guess back then it does seem like the trials were quick, right? Like compared to them now taking months or years.
Well, because they have, like, forensic evidence now.
Oh, yeah, true.
And, like...
Yeah. Like we just talked about, there were...
cameras everywhere, so we can show video. Yeah. So,
Yeah, so this time he was convicted of second-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison. So throughout both trials, Davis tried to maintain his innocence, and again, not wanting to name other people because fearing for his life or what have you.
At that point, though, like, what do you get to
lose? I know, your life in prison. Yeah, I agree.
Nothing left but to tell the truth.
Yeah, and I do have a prison shot record of him.
Oh, wow.
Yes, so I will show you that.
That's awesome.
I can't determine, because it had mentioned that he had been in prison before, so it was hard to tell, like, which one it was.
At least you know what he looks
like.
That's
cool. So after spending nearly a decade in prison, so about 10 years, Governor John Mickey paroled Davis in 1905, expressing doubts about his guilt. And so he got released. And then, unfortunately, after he was released, he kind of just vanished from records. It's really leaving, like, so many unanswered questions about his life, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there was an article mentioning he worked doing buttons or something, making buttons in prison, and so that he went somewhere else to go work at a button factory. Mm-hmm. But also, like, Davis is a very common last name. However, George Washington, I feel like that's pretty cool. And I was expecting at the beginning, like, oh, there's not probably many George Washington, like, just average people.
Yeah.
But that didn't seem to be true. So then, yeah, so basically just, you know, the Rock Island train wreck, it remains like that haunting reminder that for the potential for injustice within the legal system. It also highlights the importance of organizations. Like, I was kind of doing a deep dive into the Innocence Project, mm-hmm. which they work to exonerate wrongfully convicted individuals and just reform the criminal justice system. And they've been around since, I believe, 1992.
Yeah.
And according to their webpage and their research, they estimated 2.3 to 5% of all prisoners in the U.S. are innocent. So it's a staggering number, and it just puts a focus sort of on people like George Washington Davis into perspective, especially back then,
right,
when they didn't have DNA and they didn't have, like you just mentioned, all those things that could really prove your innocence.
Right.
So.
Or your guilt.
Or your guilt. Yeah, exactly. True. The flip of the coin. So in more recent years, it was interesting just to learn kind of the journey of this whole Rock Island train wreck, and thanks to part of this guy named Joel Williamson, he wrote a novel called The Barrel House Boys, which draws from like historical records from the time, and he did a lot of research on this particular incident. And then in 2010, he worked to get a historical marker put in right literally at the site where the train had derailed.
Oh, cool.
And they had, in 2019, they celebrated the 125th anniversary of the tragedy with, like, a candlelight vigil. So it's pretty cool to see.
Like, the families of
That are just, like, making a mark on this historical moment, right?
Yeah.
And remembering those, the people who helped, first of all, the people who unfortunately didn't make it, and then even George Davis, who was wrongfully imprisoned.
It's good he wasn't. Like, I looked at a lot of stories where the convicted person was hung or...
Yeah, like, true.
Like,
you didn't even get a chance to even ever have someone...
Like, they would... Like, their convictions were overturned, but they had already suffered the cost, you know? So, it was good he got out and...
Like, I agree.
And it was overturned before his life was taken.
I agree. And this is... the person. So I should mention he is also African-American, so that played a big role in the records back then and just the racism, which unfortunately we have in this world. But here he is. So that's him. So he looks
Really good quality picture,
isn't
too.
It for back then? Like, seriously.
Yeah, what kind of camera are they using? I know. That's a really high quality. Like, some of them we've seen, it's blurry,
and you can't even get it. So, and what was really interesting about this this story was there's actual pictures of, like, the wreckage, and it kind of hauntingly, like, there's this one picture here I'm showing you where it's everyone's crowding around the site, and it mentioned that you could still see the remains of the conductor and someone else, like that's what those people were looking at.
Thanks.
But it's kind of crazy that this happened one night, right? August 9th. By August 10th, they had cleared away everything through mm-hmm. a crane.
Wow.
And then it took 1 week and they rebuilt the tracks. Like, that's some pretty quick turnaround for resources back money, then. Yeah.
You know, they got to get those train loads through. Yeah.
Here's the other thing. The other theory was that there were, I think, about 5 railroad companies at that time. So there was a theory that they were sabotaging each other to make more money within their own.
I've heard other stories where they would send people out to wreck the rails and cause put like dynamite on the tracks.
Yeah. So. And that's like this one thing I was reading was saying like back then you would think people would like try to rob the train or do all the, and it wasn't that, it was the sabotage.
Yeah. Yeah, that really they wanted took to be the place. Fastest trains across the country. Yeah.
Yep. So, and here's them like rebuilding that, like the week later, rebuilding the rail. So like these pictures are just classic for that long ago.
Definitely.
And I got a lot of these out of, I believe it was a website called History Nebraska.
Mm-hmm.
So another like free genealogy thing, go to your, like wherever you're researching your historical town pages, historical genealogy.
Societies,
they often have a lot of detail. Even going to your library homepage, they have sometimes the newspapers archive there. So I could have definitely taken more time to just keep looking at these stories of different people. You know, unfortunately, fortunately for them, some of them did get out, but you lose 10 years of your life, right? For George, like, that's a big gap between the period of time where you might have a family and you might miss out on all that.
Right.
So that is what we brought to you guys for this week's episode. And we look forward to next week. We still haven't figured out which topic we're doing yet, so stay tuned.
We'll flip a coin, pick something out of a hat.
And still, please, we're really interested in like family folklore and stories you may have been told about your own family, and we'd be happy to help you research it and piece together all the things. So please reach out on social media. We've been posting the pictures and information on there as well. And lastly, just remember, it's not a matter of if you will find a shadow in your family tree, but when, because behind every family tree, there are shadows.
Thanks for listening.